Our next case is number 20-13364, Quincy Williams versus Correctional Officer Radford et al. Mr. Corkin.
Good morning. May I please the court? Russell Gorkin from Proskauer Rose, appointed to represent the appellant, Quincy Williams.
Mr. Gorkin, before we start, I want to thank you on behalf of not only Mr. Williams, but the court for you and the firm taking the case. We really do appreciate your service.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So, Mr. Gorkin, before you begin, I want to tell you what I want you to focus on, and I'm just speaking for me, and what I'm troubled by in this case. And that is a prior decision of ours called Bennett, and what that decision means as applied to here. Because it seems to me that Bennett could be read, and maybe should be read, to create, I don't want to call it a special rule, but in a very factually similar case, seemed to disregard allegations that were made by the prisoner there that would have been more serious than the court ultimately accepted in that case.
Are you referring to McBride, or this is another case, Bennett, you're talking about?
No, I'm referring to...
He's talking about the 1990 Bennett decision.
Bennett versus Parker. 1990 decision of our court. It's cited in the magistrate's R&R. It's cited in the government's brief, the government's red brief. And if you're not familiar enough with it, then tell me, so because I don't want to put you in an uncomfortable position. But I will tell you that part of why this case is here for oral argument is because of tension that I see between things that we said in that case and things we've said in other cases about where someone swears either in a deposition, where a prisoner swears in a deposition or in an affidavit about things happening, and whether we accept those things as true in the application of the Campbell factors.
I understand. So my understanding, this is a summary judgment question, what's sufficient to create a genuine issue of material fact as far as the evidence goes? And I would refer Your Honor to Hall v. Bennett, which says when there are conflicting accounts, and you can make those conflicting accounts with a verified affidavit, with depositions, that those are sufficient unless those are blatantly contradicted by video evidence or other physical evidence. And here, that's just simply not the case. In fact, there's
And counsel, that has been my understanding. If without reading this, that is my understanding of summary judgment law, both in the prisoner context and outside of it. And it would seem to me that applying that principle without anything else, that you would seem to win on the excessive force claim, which is the one there. So that's just my view of it. But there's this decision that I would urge you to take a look at some point. That seems to suggest, and I don't, there's different ways to look at it, but seems to suggest that, at least in the application of some of the Campbell factors, that conclusory statements or allegations or just the allegations of the prisoner are insufficient unless corroborated, whether by medical testimony or some other witness testimony.
So here we do have corroboration for the excessive force claim. We have an affidavit from an eyewitness.
I've read, is it... Kunta Parker, is that the Kunta?
Porter.
Porter. I've read Mr. Porter's affidavit, and Mr. Porter's affidavit corroborates some things, but not all things. Here's what I think it corroborates, and tell me if I'm wrong. As to injury, it seems to corroborate a busted lip, but not any of the other very extreme things that your client alleges. And as to the force, it corroborates a punch, and it corroborates, I think, holding him against the wall. But it doesn't corroborate any choking, and it doesn't corroborate six or seven punches. Is that a fair reading of the Porter affidavit?
I think it corroborates more than a single punch, but I would argue the key issue in this case, even a single punch, so long as that's corroborated, is
also,
whether...
Also, the verified complaint said he was handcuffed. I mean, we have to accept that as true.
He was handcuffed. Absolutely correct. Thank you, Judge Lagoa. The critical issue in this case is whether... Mr. Williams was engaged at disorderly conduct when he arrived at C dorm confinement. Because if a jury could reasonably find that he was not engaged at disorderly conduct at that point in time, then being slammed into a wall or pushed into a wall or punched in the face would constitute corporal punishment and not an immediate corrective measure necessitated by the spontaneous violation of a prison rule.
Did he not testify in his deposition, pages 59 and 60, that he was, quote, very outspoken, quote, just loud, just talking, quote, verbal words and stuff, and to the extent of being, quote, disorderly?
He did. And so the distinction that I'm making, and I think this is very important in the record, is the record shows that the only disorderly conduct, the disorderly conduct to which you're referring, happened on the way to Mr. Williams' pre-confinement medical exam, not on the way from pre-confinement to the C dorm. And certainly it did not continue all the way until he arrived there. As a result, a jury could conclude that the beating the officers inflicted was not in service of maintaining and restoring discipline. In that case, decorum had already prevailed.
So if you look at, again, if you look at the Bennett case.
If I can, Stephanie, Ms. Tisa, could you please give it to him? This is my copy. Thank you. So he has it. Thank you.
When you have an opportunity to take a look at it, when you sit down.
We'll give you time to do it when you have a seat, and then we can talk about it in rebuttal. That might be a better way to.
And I appreciate it. I just want to flag this issue
yep.
for them.
Yep.
What was considered disorderly there seemed to me to be far, far less than what I just quoted from you from the deposition. There, all the guy did was just question why the officers had taken a particular action contrary to one they promised earlier. And from that, a fairly violent incident happened. And yet that, we said, was sufficient to use some degree of force, and there's disputes about that degree of force.
So I'll review the case.
Please, thank you.
My understanding of the law from the cases that I've reviewed is that a handcuffed prisoner who makes an offensive or perhaps disrespectful remark to a prison guard does not give that prison guard license to then punch that prisoner repeatedly in the face. I don't believe that's law. I'll review the case and comment on that. And I think it's clear.
So when you get a chance to look at it when your colleague is up, I think what Judge Lux said about the disorderly conduct in that case sort of mirrors what happened here, maybe even more significant than what happened here. But I think there are a couple of ways that you can read Bennett to not cause you a problem here. One is that Bennett was a summary judgment case, and we said that the plaintiff there presented no evidence to support his claim that he was struck with a nightstick. So the force there involved a grabbing of by the throat and pushing him up against the bars, but not the nightstick. And here you've got, I think, evidence viewed in the light most favorable to your client that he was punched while handcuffed. So I think that's one possible way of reading Bennett and distinguishing it. The second is that Bennett has a lot of discussion about the triviality of the injuries. And since then, Bennett was 1990, and since then, in 2010, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Grady that it doesn't matter in an Eighth Amendment excessive force case whether the defendant has serious injury. That a defendant who is gratuitously beaten by guards does not lose his ability to pursue an excessive force claim just because he has the good fortune to escape without serious injury. The inquiry is not whether or not he was injured severely, but whether the nature of the force used was applied maliciously and sadistically to cause harm. So at least part of Bennett's focus on the severity of the injury, if not abrogated, is undercut and undermined by the Supreme Court's later decision in Grady. So those are two possible ways of reading Bennett in a way that's not necessarily inconsistent with your excessive force claim.
Thank you, Judge Jordan. And I would just add to that this court has embraced Wilkins v. Gaddy in a published decision, Sconiers v. Lockhart, decided approximately 2 years in 2020.
Let me ask you this. Do you agree that under Campbell that the injury, the significance of injury is a factor to be considered in the ultimate constitutional, what the Supreme Court has called the core inquiry of whether it was a legitimate penological use of force or a sadistic and malicious harmful activity to the prisoner.
Yes, that is certainly one of the five factors to be considered.
Right.
Here, I would point out, though, that the incident took place on December 23rd. My client requested medical treatment that day. He filed a sick call request on December 24th. It was not received until December 27th, and he was not seen for medical treatment until January 3rd.
What did the medical records show?
And that's part of the record.
Sorry. No, I apologize, Judge Lugo.
Yes. Judge Lugo, that...
Lugo first.
That is part of the record.
And it shows
and so
left
his,
shoulder pain, neck swollen, headache.
No, it doesn't. But my point is that with approximately 12 or 13 days elapsing between when the incident occurred and when he was seen for treatment, it's not inconsistent that he did in fact suffer those injuries. And then he was seen for treatment, they weren't registered.
Which
now,
one,
I would
which
also.
Which one is the one, though, that shows mechanism of injury? It says assaulted by CO.
So, I'm sorry.
I think Judge Lugo is talking about the form, the medical, intake form.
The intake form.
The intake form on January 3rd?
No, the request.
The request, yes. And sorry, what is the question, Judge Lugo?
I'm sorry. I thought that this was from, I have it as.
That's what triggered the ultimate.
Right.
His ultimate being seen by medical professionals, right? Where he said he was assaulted.
Correct.
And the nurse ultimately concluded, at least in her observation, the week later after he was seen, that there were no significant injuries of any kind.
That's all correct. That's all correct. I would also like to briefly touch on the retaliation claim. I understand the focus here is certainly the excessive force claim. But
can I ask you a question about that? So as I understand the retaliation claim, there seems to be three separate claims. And maybe they're not, but it seems to me there are three separate ones. There's the retaliation for telling the assistant warden about what happened with his mail. There is, when he's then put in solitary confinement, he grieves that, and then there is a random search of, a non-random search, he alleges, of his cell. He complains about that, and then there's the planting of the knife. Is that fair?
I think there's actually one more.
Okay.
So there's the October 27th grievance, related to the mail. There's a visit by Captain Scarpati and Officer Gorman to his visit to his cell on November 7th, and he complains about both of those in the same grievance on November 20th, which was received on November 27th. And then on December 13th, Officer Redmond conducted a cell search where he contends the search trashed his cell, damaging his property and his legal papers, and said, quote, stop writing up Captain Scarpati. And so it's that third incident that I want to talk about as far as a retaliation claim, because in a single sentence, the court found that there was no causal connection between the adverse action, the trashing of his cell, and Mr. Williams's First Amendment right to challenge the conditions of his confinement by filing grievances, because Captain Scarpati issued a one-sentence conclusory denial in his affidavit that cell searches are conducted randomly. But crediting Captain Scarpati's one-sentence denial over the evidence submitted by Williams to conclude that this event would have happened absent Williams having written a grievance against him improperly invaded the province of the jury, because Captain Scarpati did not submit any evidence, testimonial or otherwise, to explain how cells are randomly selected. For example, he didn't even deny that he selects which cells are selected or when. So in the absence of any evidence as to whether how this random, quote unquote, search happens, combined with the fact that we have evidence also corroborated by an eyewitness account from Mr. Harris that Officer Redmond said, stop writing up Captain Scarpati while trashing his cell, one, a reasonable jury could find that the causal connection, which is a subjective factor, was motivated by an attempt to chill Mr. Williams's First Amendment rights.
All right, thank you very much. We'll give you your time for rebuttal, and then we can talk a little bit more about Bennett. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Sutter.
Good May it please the court. I'm Chris Sutter, Assistant Attorney General, representing the appellees in this matter.
So, Mr. Sutter, I'll start where I started with your opposing counsel, and that is, at least in my view, absent Bennett, it seems to me that the evidence, the verified complaint plus the deposition testimony seems to at least create a genuine issue of material fact of most, if not all, of the Campbell factors on the excessive force claim. But Bennett seems to suggest that we view evidence a little more skeptically in this context. And I'd like your take on Bennett, and then I want to ask you some, I'll take the track that Judge Jordan did to ask you some ways to, that I think it might be able to be distinguished or not apply in this case, so.
As I understand Bennett, what we're looking at here is that much of, that the prison guards are given a level of,
Here, let me see if I can focus you a little bit, so you can answer Judge Luck's question. I think you were headed in the direction of saying that prison guards deal with a very difficult environment, and they're given some leeway in deciding what force has to be used in different circumstances, right? And I think all of us would agree with that. And so the question and the way to talk about Bennett is, there's certainly a difference between the use of some force with a disorderly inmate and the use of all force. And the question is, where in the continuum does this case, viewed in the summary judgment prism, fall? Right? So I'll speak for myself only. I think if the officers had grabbed Mr. Williams and pushed him against a wall, I don't think there would be, under our precedent, an excessive force claim, right? But once having quelled the disorderly nature of his outburst, given that he's handcuffed, they can't just take a baseball bat to his head, right? You would agree with that?
I agree with that.
Okay, so the question is, viewed under Bennett, like, where does this case fall? And I think that's just Luck's question to you. Where does it fall in the continuum, and how do we work around or through Bennett? How do we apply Bennett in this sort of factual circumstance?
That's actually not my question. Let me ask my question.
My apologies, then.
My question is this. In Bennett, as best as I can read the decision, the allegations are that not only, as Judge Jordan articulated, was the prisoner grabbed and was he put up against the wall and was yelled at racial slurs, but also that a nightstick was taken against his head, the left side of his head, near his eye, which caused significant pain. The court said, we are not going to consider that statement because it's not corroborated. Do we apply that same standard here for non-corroborated allegations?
You have a non-corroborated allegation here, and you also have the self-admission by the appellant that he was disorderly in his transfer coming from the initial situation over to the facility.
There's no doubt, he was disorderly, and there's no doubt, as Judge Jordan said, some force was allowed to be used here. The question is the amount. Judge Jordan's 100% right to ask that. But my question is, Bennett seems to say that in determining the amount, we look not just to what the plaintiff said happened, but we look to the corroborated allegations that the plaintiff said happened. In that case, the prisoner affidavit only verified or corroborated that he was taken and I think choked and pushed up against the wall, but not the nightstick. Here, the only corroborated allegation that I can tell from Mr. Porter's affidavit is that he's grabbed, put up against the wall, and punched one time. It just says punched. That's what it says. Do we look at only what's corroborated, or do we look at all of it?
I would look at only what is corroborated.
You do this sort of work, counsel. Is that consistent with a lot of other cases that we have said? Because it seems to me we have a ton of law that says we look at self-serving affidavits all the time.
And just like, I'm sorry for interrupting.
Oh, please.
Like Sears versus Roberts, you're looking at situations where if it's just strictly affidavit versus affidavit, it's a different story.
So, thank you for bringing up Sears.
In this situation, it's distinguished in that you don't have any evidence coming from the appellant that shows we ourselves denied that this even occurred. Everything was portrayed in the light most favorable based on the allegations presented to show that we had a situation where he was disorderly. He was being brought forth. There's no evidence or even statements made that what was being done was malicious or sadistic in the situation
I'm glad you brought up Sears, because this seems to be a Sears-like situation. You have a verified complaint and a deposition where he's saying, this happened to me, including that, as Judge Jordan absolutely correctly articulated, that he was held, handcuffs, and punched 6 or 7 times in the face right after the disorderly conduct happened. And then we have the other party saying, this never happened, this is a complete fabrication and a lie. How is that not a classic swearing match? And then my ultimate question to you is, what do we do with Bennett? Because it seems inconsistent with Sears and other cases where in the classic swearing match, the tie goes to the prisoner on the summary judgment.
What we have to look at is the evidence presented and the statements made by the appellant in this situation. We have a situation where he did not address where you had a disorderly incident. You had a situation where, if you go towards the First Amendment retaliation claim, that he was being charged. He was found guilty of.
Focus on the focus on the excessive force first, because the alleged retaliatory acts occur in different time periods with different sorts of alleged conduct. I think I've got you right.
You do.
That Judge Luck is focused on the excessive force allegations and the proof about them on the two sides of the aisle. Right? He says, testifies along with a verified complaint, that he was handcuffed. He admits that he was disorderly. But after they pushed him up against the wall or the bars, he says that they punched him 6 or 7 times.
Right.
That's what he testified to, right?
That's what he testified to.
Okay, so you have to take that aspect of it, you've got to take as a given, right? That's what happened.
Well, in the light most favorable, taken by as the court took it in its determination.
Sure, so you have to agree with him that that's what happened to him. What that means legally is a different question, but factually, you have to
accept
that that's
most favorable. Those are the facts accepted by the court in their review of this matter.
Okay.
I would also be looking at the situation where, including McBride versus Rivers, which is also a very similar situation, where in what Magistrate Judge Reed used primarily in her opinion, in that could the corrections officers arguably have used less force after restraining the prisoner? And the question has to focus on whether the officials applied force maliciously and sadistically for the purpose of causing harm. What we have argued is that this is for a restoration of order. He was disorderly. He was being led to the confinement area. It's been determined that just yelling and screaming or making noise can disrupt or create an unsafe situation for the security officers.
Counsel, there's no doubt that the need is there, but the need is one factor of 5 that Campbell tells us to look at. And what I want to focus on is those other factors, because I think you do meet some need. I don't think, again, as Judge Jordan said, if at the very least all that was taken was he was grabbed and put up against the wall and there was maybe some other slight physical force, we probably wouldn't be here. But there was more than that. And so the question is, given what he says his injuries were, given what the type of activity that he says happened, given the amount of force that was put on there, that he suffered, given those factors that Campbell lays out, how can we conclude, at least on summary judgment, that you're right as a matter of law?
I would take you back to the opinion that was, R&R that was provided by Magistrate Reed as she was drawing the comparisons with McBride, where in McBride, the force used was far greater than the amount of force used in this situation, where he was kneed multiple times, 4 to 6 times on the left side of his face, and that he may have been stunned during the altercation, but that the force, and this as well was a situation where he was being escorted to segregation because of a disciplinary infraction. So with the amount of force used here was found to be much less than that used in another similar case. And in with Bennett, you're trying to...
The McBride case is unpublished. You would agree?
I would agree, yes. Again, I would focus back to that the amount of force is the amount of force necessary at that moment as it was encountered. We have no information in the affidavits from the other party that shows what led up to the force that was observed and what was the situation at that moment. No one mentions that if he was yelling or not in the affidavits provided by the appellant. We have reports that he was disorderly on his transfer over to the confinement area. He was met there, and according to the appellant, force was used. We do have I would argue that the amount of force used was that amount of force that was needed at that moment to bring order to the situation before bringing him into confinement.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to add?
We would refer to our brief and any other questions you may have.
All right, thank you so much.
Counsel, did you have enough time? I want to give you the time. It's worth taking a minute or two to give you the time.
I appreciate that.
Is that okay, Judge Jordan?
Of course.
Thank you.
Let us know when you're done speed reading. Mr. Gorkin, how much, we're not rushing you. How much time do you think you need?
2 minutes.
Okay. You know what? We'll take a 5-minute break. That way you'll have plenty of time. We'll come back in 5 minutes, okay? Okay, welcome back. Please be seated. Okay, Mr. Gorkin.
And thank you.
So thank you for the time to review Bennett v. Parker.
Sure.
There are 4 points I would like to make in response. The first is, as you noted, Judge Jordan, that Bennett v. Parker was about the severity of the injury. I'd also like to note that it was decided in the context of qualified immunity, and so the constitutional right had to be clearly established by that time. But as Your Honor observed...
Except that as you know, qualified immunity is two-pronged, and they only decided on prong one. They didn't. There's a statement at the end where they said we don't have to reach the clearly established because there's no violation of the right here. That's how I read that part. In other words, I think you'd be right if they decided on prong two, and maybe they should have, but they seem to decide on prong one.
Then let me just jump to my 4th point, actually, now in response to that excellent point, Judge Luck, which is that the Eighth Amendment is about contemporary standards of decency. And it's about what shocks the conscience. And although 1990 is not a century ago, it is 32 years ago. We're talking about Rodney King, and we know what's happened since then. Eric Garner, George Floyd, so on and so forth. And so I would contend that 32 years later, there's no obligation of this court to be beholden to a finding there that this type of conduct is acceptable under the Eighth Amendment because it necessarily evolves with the times. The second point I would like to make is that, as you observed again, Judge Jordan, the affidavits, the supporting evidence there, did not support the use of a nightstick. So as you said, it was pushing against bars.
But the problem is, again, that's one possible way to massage it, but part of the problem is that Bennett seems to almost read like you're requiring corroboration of what the inmate is testifying to. Now, even that's not crystal clear because the initial part of the opinion tells you what's being alleged and what the parties claim, but doesn't tell you what evidence was presented, whether there was a declaration or an affidavit or a deposition. So it's sort of a little bit hazy and unclear. But if you read that snippet in the middle, it looks like the court is almost disregarding the nightstick allegation because it wasn't corroborated. And if that's the case, then that presents a potential problem for you. On the other hand, that may not be the best or only way of trying to figure out what Bennett means.
So again, I'm not sure that Bennett is necessarily dispositive because, as your honors are aware, there is a host of other binding precedent in the circuit about what is sufficient on summary judgment when they're, you know, to corroborate one plaintiff's story. And again, I would refer to Hall v. Bennett, which cites the Poor Morgani Esfahani v. G case. And we need blatant contradiction by video or physical evidence. And here that was requested and not made available.
The problem is under our prior panel precedent rule that those decisions post-date, do not predate the Bennett decision. So I think the answer is, even it seems to me that we may have cases predating Bennett that hold similarly to that. And if they do, then maybe that Bennett is inconsistent with prior panel precedent and it would be something we can disregard in that way. But I think we have to do a deep dive on that.
I see that I'm over my time, but with your permission and indulgence, may I make one final point?
Sure, you got 30 seconds.
Williams v. Burton, this court's decision, 1991, and I quote, "Once the necessity for the application of force ceases, any continued use of harmful force can be a violation of the Eighth Amendment." And so here, there's a question about when the disorderly conduct occurred versus when the excessive force was imposed. And the record is crystal clear that it happened on the way to medical confinement. And so how long is too long before the excessive force becomes corporal punishment rather than, and I quote, Ort v. White, an immediate corrective action necessary to remedy a spontaneous violation of a prison rule?
All right. Thank you both very much. Mr. Gorkin, Mr. Sutter, thank you.